My old tutor still wears his long robes, despite the rain, and he shakes water from the folds of his faded yellow clothing. No use in it. The rain keeps pelting down, smoothing out the slight curls of his gray-streaked hair.
"I was hoping to catch you at home," he calls over the hissing downpour. "Well, honestly, I was hoping to catch you indisposed so I could do this in the morning, instead of out in this infernal wet." Julian shakes his head like a dog and pushes his hair away from his eyes.
"Say what you came here to say, Julian." I cross my arms. As the night falls, so does the temperature. I might catch a chill, even here in steaming Piedmont. Julian doesn't reply. Instead, his eyes flick to Killorn, one eyebrow raised in silent question.
"He's fine," I say, answering before he can ask.
"Speak up before we all drown out here."
My tone sharpens, and so does Julian. He isn't a fool. His face falls, reading the disappointment etched on me.
"I know you feel abandoned," he begins, choosing his words with maddening care.
I can't help but bristle. "Stick to history. I won't let you lecture me on what I'm allowed to feel."
He only blinks, taking my response in stride. Again, he pauses, long enough to let a raindrop roll down his straight nose. He does it to gauge me, to measure, to study. For the first time, his patient manner makes me want to seize him by the shoulders and shake some impulsive words out of him.
"Very well," he says, his voice low and wounded. "Then, in the interest of history, or what will very soon be history, I am still accompanying my nephew on your journey west. I would like to see the Free Republic for myself, and I think I can be of use to Cal there."
Julian starts to take a step forward, toward me, but thinks better of it. He keeps his distance.
"Does Tiberius have some interest in obscure history that I don't know about?"
I scoff, the words coming out harsher than usual. He looks torn. That much is very clear. He can barely look me in the eye. The rain plasters his hair to his forehead, clings to his lashes, pulls at him with tiny fingers. It smooths him out somehow, as if washing away his days. Julian seems younger than when I met him, almost a year ago. Less sure of himself, full of worry and doubt.
"No," he concedes. "While I normally encourage my nephew to pursue all knowledge he can, there are some things I'd like to steer him away from. Some stones he should not waste time trying to overturn."
I raise an eyebrow.
"What do you mean?"
Julian frowns.
"I assume he mentioned his hopes for Maven before."
"Before he chose the crown over me."
"He did," I whisper, sounding small.
"He thinks there might be some way to fix his brother, heal the wounds of Ilara Mirandus."
Slowly, Julian shakes his head.
"But there is no completing a puzzle with missing pieces, or putting a shattered pane of glass back together."
My stomach twists, tensing with what I already know, what I've seen firsthand.
"It's impossible."
Julian nods.
"Impossible and hopeless. A doomed pursuit. One that will only break my boy's heart."
"What makes you think I still care about his heart?"
I sneer, tasting the bitter lie. Julian takes a wary step forward.
"Go easy on him,"
he murmurs. I snap back without blinking.
"How dare you say that to me?"
"Mare, do you remember what you found in those books?"
he asks, pulling his robes tight around himself. His voice takes on a pleading edge.
"Do you remember the words?"
I shiver, and it isn't because of the rain. "Not a god's chosen, but a god's cursed."
"Yes,"
he replies, nodding along with fervent motion.
It reminds me of the way he used to teach, and I brace for a lecture.
This is not a new concept, Mayor. Men and women have felt that way in some capacity for thousands of years, chosen or cursed, fated or doomed, since the dawn of sentience, I suspect, and long before silver and red or any type of ability. Did you know kings and politicians and rulers of every kind used to think they were blessed by the gods, ordained to their place in the world? Many thought themselves chosen, but a few, of course, saw the duty as a curse.
Next to me, Killorn puffs out a low scoff. I'm more obvious, rolling my eyes at Julian. When I shift, so does the collar of my shirt, sending a steady drip of rainwater down my spine. I clench my fists to keep from flinching.
Are you saying your nephew is cursed to his crown?
I sneer. Julian hardens, and I feel a tinge of regret for being so callous. He shakes his head at me, like I'm a child to be scolded.
Forced to choose between the woman he loves and what he thinks is right? What he thinks he must do because of everything he's been taught to be? What else would you call that?
I call it an easy decision,
Killorn growls. I bite down hard on the inside of my cheek, trying to gnaw back a dozen rude responses.
Did you really come here to defend what he did? Because I'm certainly not in the mood for it.
No, of course not, Mayor,
Julian replies.
But to explain, if I can.
My stomach churns at the thought of Julian, of all people, explaining his nephew's heart to me. With his dissections and ruminations, will he boil it down to simple science? An equation to show that the crown and I are not equal in the prince's eyes? I simply can't stand it.
Save your breath, Julian,
I spit.
Go back to your king. Stand at his side.
I look him dead in the eye, so he knows I'm not lying.
And keep him safe.
He sees the offer for what it is. The only thing I can do. Julian Jacos bows low. He sweeps out his soaking robes in an attempt at courtly manner. For a second, we could be back in Somerton. Just him and me in a classroom piled with books. Back then I lived in terror, forced to masquerade as someone else. Julian was one of my only refuges in that place, alongside Cal and Maven, my only sanctuaries. The Kalor brothers are gone. I think Julian might be too.
I will, Mayor, he tells me. With my life, if I must.
I hope it doesn't come to that.
So do I.
Our words are warnings to each other, and his voice sounds like a goodbye. I think Bree keeps his eyes closed for the entire flight, not to sleep. He just really despises flying, so much so he can hardly look at his own feet, let alone peek out the window. He doesn't even respond to Trainee's and Geesa's gentle teasing. They sit on either side of him, content to poke and prod. Geesa stage whispers to Trainee, leaning across Bree to say something about jet crashes or engine malfunctions. I don't join in. I know what a jet crash feels like, or at least close to it, but I won't spoil their fun either. We get so little of it these days. Bree keeps still in his seat, arms tightly crossed, his lids glued shut. Eventually his head lolls forward, chin resting on his chest, and he sleeps the rest of the way. It's no small accomplishment on his part, considering the route from the Piedmont base to the Free Republic of Montfort is one of the longest flights I've ever taken. 6 hours of flying, at least. Too long a journey for a drop jet, so we're on a larger carrier, a transport more like the Black Run. But this isn't the same craft, thankfully. The Black Run was torn apart last year by a contingent of Samos warriors and Maven's own fury. I glance down the fuselage to the silhouettes of two pilots working the jet. Men of Montfort. I don't know either of them. Killorn hangs at their backs, watching them fly. Like Bree, Mom isn't keen on the flight, but Dad twists with his forehead glued to the glass, eyes on the land as it sprawls out below. The rest of the Montfort escort, Davidson and his advisors, spend the time sleeping. They must intend to hit the ground running when they get home. Farley sleeps, too, her face pressed up against her seat. She took a spot without a window. Flying still makes her ill. She is the only representative from the Scarlet Guard. Even in sleep, she curls her arms around Clara, rocking with the motion of the jet to keep her settled. The colonel is back at the base, and probably ecstatic about it. With Farley gone, he's the highest-ranking member of the Scarlet Guard left behind. He can play command all he likes while his daughter relays information back to the organization. On the ground, the verdant green of Piedmont, braided with muddy rivers and rolling hills, steadily gives over to the floodplain of the Great River. The disputed lands line both banks, their borders strange and always changing. I know little about them, except the obvious. The Lakelands, Piedmont, Prairie, and even Taraxis, farther south, fight over this stretch of mud, swamp, hill, and tree. For control of the river, mostly. I hope. Silvers fight for nothing most of the time, spilling red blood for less than dirt. They control this land, too, but not as tightly as they do Norta and the Lakelands. We fly on, heading west over the flat grasslands and gentle hills of prairie. Some is farmland, wheat sprouts in golden waves, patchworked with corn in endless rows. The rest looks like open landscape, pocked by the occasional forest or lake. Prairie has no kings that I know of, no queens, no princes. Their lords rule by right of power, not blood. When a father falls, his son does not always take his place. It's another country I never thought I'd see, but here I am, looking down at it. It never goes away, this strange feeling bubbling up from the odd divide between who I was before and who I am now. A girl of the stilts, of familiar mud, trapped in a small place until the doom of conscription. My future was so empty then, but was it easier than this? I feel detached from that life, a million miles and 1,000 years ago. Julian isn't on our carrier, or else I might be tempted to ask about the countries beneath us. He's on the other air jet, the Laris jet, striped yellow, with the rest of the Kalor and Samos representatives, as well as their guards, not to mention their baggage. Apparently a would-be king and a princess require a good deal of clothes. They trail behind us, visible from the left side windows, metal wings flashing as we chase the sun. Ella told me she came from the prairie lands before Montfort, the Sandhills, Raider Country. More terms I don't really understand. She isn't here to explain, left behind at the Piedmont base with Wraith. Titan is the only Electricon coming with us. Besides me, of course. He's Montfort-born. I suspect he has a family to visit, and friends, too. He sits near the rear of the jet, sprawled across two empty seats, his nose buried in a tattered book. As I look at him, he feels my gaze, and he meets my eyes for a brief second. He blinks, gray orbs calculating. I wonder if he can feel the tiny pulses of electricity in my brain. Does he know what each one means? Can he distinguish between bursts of fear or excitement? Could I, one day? I hardly know the depth of my own abilities. It's the same for all new bloods I've met and helped train. But maybe not in Montfort. Maybe they understand what we are and how much we can do. The next thing I know, someone nudges my arm, jolting me out of an uneasy sleep. Dad points at the rounded window between us, set into the curved wall behind our seats.
"Never thought I'd see anything like that," he says, wrapping the thick glass.
"What?" I ask, adjusting myself. He snaps the buckle on my belts, giving me full range of motion to turn and look out. I have seen mountains before, in the Great Woods, from the Notch. Green ranges fading into autumn's fire, and then winter's barren, bone-branched chill. In the rift, where hunched ridges ripple into the horizon, rising and falling like leafy waves. In Piedmont, deep in the backcountry, their slopes shifting into blue and distant purple, glimpsed only from the windows of a jet. All of them were part of the Alatias, the long line of ancient mountains marching from Norda to the Piedmont interior. But I have never seen mountains like the ones before us. I don't think they can even be called mountains at all. My jaw hangs open, eyes glued to the horizon as the jet arcs toward the north. The flat prairie lands end abruptly, their western edge punctured by the wall of a vast and sheer mountain range, bigger than anything I've ever seen before. The slopes rise like knife edges, too sharp, too high, rows upon rows of jagged, gigantic teeth. Some of the peaks are bare, without trees, as if trees can't grow up there. A few mountains in the distance are capped in white snow, even though it's summer. I draw in a shaky breath. What kind of country have we come to? Do Silvers and Ardents rule so completely, with enough strength to build an impossible land like this? The mountains put a fear in me, but a little excitement, too. Even from the air, this country feels different. The Free Republic of Montfort stirs something in my blood and bone. Next to me, Dad puts a hand to the glass. His fingers brush over the silhouette of the range, tracing the peaks. "Beautiful," he murmurs, so low only I can hear. "I hope this place is good to us. It's cruel to give hope where none should be." My father said that once, in the shadow of a stilt house. He sat in a chair, missing a leg. I used to think he was broken. I know better now. Dad is as whole as the rest of us, and always has been. He just wanted to protect us from the pain of wanting what we could not have. Futures we would never be allowed. Our fates have been quite different. And it seems my father has changed with them. He can hope. With a deep breath, I realize the same. Even after Maven, my long months of imprisonment, all the death and destruction I've seen or caused, my broken heart still bleeding inside me, the unending fear for the people I love and the people I want to save, it all remains a constant weight. But I won't let it drown me. I can still hope, too.
6. Evangeline. The air is strange, thin, oddly clean, as if removed from the rest of the world. I smell it around the edges of my iron, my silver, my chrome, and of course the metallic tang of the jets, their engines still hot from the journey. The feel of them is overpowering, even after long hours cramped in the belly of a Laris carrier. So many plates and pipes and screws. On the flight, I spent longer than I care to admit counting rivets and tracing metal seams. If I tore there or there or there, I could send Cal or Annabelle or anyone I wished plummeting to their death. Even myself. I had to sit near a Haven Lord for much of the trip, and his snore rivaled thunder. Jumping out of a jet almost seemed like a better choice. Despite the time of year, the air is colder than I expected, and goosebumps rise beneath the sheer silk draped over my shoulders. I took care to dress as a princess should, even though now I suffer the chill for it. This is my first state visit, both as a representative of the Rift and as the future queen of Norda. If that cursed future comes to pass, I must look the part. Impressive and formidable down to my painted toes. I have to be prepared. I am well beyond the bounds of the world I understand. I inhale again, sucking down an oddly shallow breath. Even breathing here is unfamiliar. It isn't late enough for sunset, but the mountains are so tall, and already the light wanes. Long shadows race across the landing field, cut deep into the valley. I feel as if I could touch the sky, run my jeweled claws across the clouds, and make the sky bleed red starlight. Instead, I keep my hands at my sides, my many rings and bracelets hidden beneath the folds of my skirt and sleeves. Decoration only. Pretty, useless, silent things. Just like my parents want me to be. At the far end of the jet runway, the land drops away in a cliff. The carved edges of the mountainsides frame the horizon like a window. Cal stands silhouetted, looking eastward, where evening falls in shades of hazy purple. The mountain range casts shadows of its own, and all the world seems to fade in a darkness of Montfort's making. Cal isn't alone. His uncle, the infinitely odd Jaco's lord, stands at his side. He jots something in a notebook, moving with the excited, nervous energy of a tiny bird. Two guards, one in Laralan colors, orange and red, with the other in Laris yellow, flank them from a respectful distance. The exiled prince stares out, still but for the wind in his scarlet cape. Reversing his house colors was a smart decision, to distance himself from everything King Maven is. I shudder at the memory of that white face, those blue eyes, how every part of him seemed to burn with an all-consuming flame. There is nothing in Maven but hunger. Cal doesn't turn around until Mare is off her jet with her family, hustled to a waiting escort of Montfort attendants. The Barrow's voices echo off the stone walls of the high mountain valley. That family is quite vocal. And for someone so short and compact, Mare has surprisingly tall brothers. The sight of her younger sister turns my stomach. The girl has red hair, darker than Elaine's, without any of her bright gleam. Her skin doesn't glow, not with ability or some inner charm I can't explain. She isn't pale or alluring, either. Her face is plainly pretty, more golden, an average sort of beauty. Common. Red. Elaine is singular, in appearance and mind. She has no equal in my eyes. But still, the Barrow girl reminds me of the person I want most. The person I can never truly have. Elaine isn't here, and neither is my brother. That is the price. For his safety. For his life. General Farley will certainly kill him if given the opportunity, and I don't intend to let her have it. Not even for my own heart. Cal turns around to watch Mare disappear, his eyes on her back as the escorts lead her and her family away. My lip curls at his idiocy. She's right in front of him, and he still pushes the girl away with both hands. For something so fragile and fickle as a crown. Even so, I envy him. He could still choose her if wanted. I wish I had the opportunity to do the same.
You think my grandson is a fool, don't you?
I turn to see Annabelle Laralan watching me, her lethal fingers knitted in front of her, a rose-gold tiara winking on her head. Like the rest of us, she made an effort to look her best. Gritting my teeth, I dip into a shallow but perfect curtsy. I have no idea what you mean, Your Majesty. I don't bother trying to sound convincing. I see little consequence to it, for good or ill. It makes no difference what she thinks of me. She controls my life either way.
You're attached to the Haven girl, yes? Gerald's daughter.
Annabelle takes a daring step closer to me. I want to cut Elaine's face right out of her head.
If I'm not mistaken, she's married to your brother, a future queen as much as you are.
The threat laces through her words like one of my mother's snakes. I force a laugh. My passing fancies are not your business. One of her fingers ticks, tapping against a wizened knuckle. She purses her lips, and the wrinkles around her mouth deepen.
They are very much my business, especially when you lie so quickly to keep Elaine Haven from any kind of scrutiny. A passing fancy. Hardly, Evangeline. You are clearly smitten. She narrows her eyes. I think you'll find you and I have more in common than you believe. I smirk in her face, flashing my teeth in a veiled snarl. I know old court gossip as much as anyone else. You speak of consorts. Your husband had one, a man named Robert, and you think that gives us what, an understanding? I married a Kalor king and sat by his side while he loved another. I think I know how this, she dances two fingers in front of me, might work. And let me tell you, it works best when all parties involved are in agreement and in the know. Whether you like it or not, you and my grandson need to be allies in all things. It's the best way to survive. Survive in his shadow, you mean? I snap, unable to help myself. Annabelle blinks at me, her face pulled in rare confusion. Then she smiles and dips her head. Queens cast shadows, too. Her demeanor changes in an instant. Ah, Premier. She turns to my left toward the man standing behind me. I do the same, watching as Davidson steps forward. He nods at both of us, though he never breaks his gaze. His angled eyes, oddly gold, dart from Annabelle to me. They are the only part of him that seems alive. The rest, from his empty, bland expressions to his still fingers, seem schooled by restraint.
Your Majesty. Your Highness,
Davidson says, bobbing his head again. Over his shoulder I glance at his Montfort guards in green, as well as his officers and soldiers with their insignia. There are dozens of them. Some accompanied him from Piedmont, but most were already here waiting for his arrival. Did he always have so many guards at his back? So many guns? I feel the bullets in their chambers. I count them off, a force of habit, and thicken the pools of iron in my dress, covering my most sensitive organs. The Premier gestures with one hand, sweeping his arm.
I hope to escort you both into our capital, and be the first to bid you welcome to the Free Republic of Montfort.
Though he still does his best to remain emotionless, I sense a pride in him. Pride in his home, his country. I understand that, at least. Annabelle surveys him with a look that would level noble Silvers, men and women of terrible power and even worse arrogance. The Premier doesn't even flinch.
This, she sniffs, eyeing the naked cliffs on either side of us, is your republic. This, Davidson replies, is a private runway.
I spin a ring on my finger, distracting myself with the braid of jewels to keep from laughing. Buttons gleam at the edge of my awareness. Heavy iron, well-formed, forged into the likeness of flame. They approach, fastened to my betrothed's clothing. He stops at my side, radiating a low but constant heat. Cal says nothing to me, and I'm glad for it. We haven't truly spoken in months. Not since he escaped death in the bowl of bones. Before, when he was my betrothed for the first time, our conversations were few and dull. Cal has a mind for battle, and Mayor Barrow. Neither interests me much. I sneak a look at him and can tell his grandmother has seen to his appearance as well. Gone is the rough-cut hair and the uneven stubble across his jaw. His cheeks are smooth. His black hair neat and glossy, brushed back from his forehead. Cal looks like he just stepped out of Whitefire, ready for his own coronation, instead of a 6-hour flight on a jet carrier with a siege behind him. But his eyes are dull, hard bronze, and he doesn't wear a crown. Either Annabelle could not procure one for him, or he refused to put it on. I assume the latter.
A private runway?
Cal asks, looking down at Davidson. The Premier doesn't seem bothered by the height discrepancy. Maybe he is without the infinitely male preoccupation with size.
Yes, Davidson says. This airfield is at higher altitude and has easier access to the city of Ascendant than the fields on the plains or the valleys deeper in the mountains. I thought it best to take us up here, although the eastern ascent up the Hawkway is considered a splendid sight. When the war is over, I'd like to see it, Cal replies, trying to be polite. It does little to hide his naked disinterest. Davidson doesn't seem to mind.
When the war is over,
he echoes, his eyes glittering. Well, we wouldn't want to make you late for your address to your government. Annabelle puts her arm through Cal's, ever the doting grandmother. She leans on him more than she needs to, a fitting and calculated picture.
I wouldn't worry about that,
Davidson says with one of his easy, languid smiles.
I'm scheduled to speak before the Montfort Assembly in the morning. I'll make our case then.
Cal jolts.
Tomorrow morning. Sir, you know as well as I do that time... The assembly convenes in the morning. Tonight, I hope you'll join me for dinner,
Davidson says placidly.
Premier,
Cal begins, gritting his teeth. But the new blood is forceful and stern, albeit as apologetic as he can be.
My colleagues already agreed to hold a special session, out of season. I assure you, I'm doing what I can within the bounds of my country's laws.
Laws? Can they even exist in a country like this? With no throne, no crown, no one to make the ultimate decision while all the rest squabble over details? How can Montfort hope to survive? How can they hope to move forward with so many pulling in different directions? But if Montfort cannot move, if Davidson cannot win Cal more troops, then this war may end the way I want. It may end sooner than I thought. To Ascendant, then? I ask, hoping to get out of the settling cold, and get Cal closer to all the distraction this place can give. As Annabelle has already claimed Cal, I offer my arm to Davidson instead. He takes it with a slight bow, his hand feather-light on my wrist.
This way, Your Highness, he replies.
I'm surprised to find that the touch of a new blood is not as revolting as the touch of my betrothed. He sets a good pace, leading us away from the jets and onto the paths leading into Ascendant. The city is set high on the eastern edge of the massive mountain range, looking over the lower peaks and out over the borders. Prairie fades on the horizon, its edges known as Raider Country, where roving bands of silvers align to no nation prey upon all who cross. The rest is empty plain, marred only by the cratered remains of what was once a city, long ago. I do not know its name. Ascendant seems born of the mountains themselves, built upon slopes and into valleys, arching over gushing streams and the larger river picking its way back east through winding canyons. The few roads tunnel, and transports weave in and out of sight. There must be more beneath the surface, carved into the rock hearts of these mountains. Most of the Ascendant city buildings are quarried stone, granite, marble, and rock quartz, cut and sculpted into impossibly smooth slabs of white and gray. Pine trees, some taller than spires, sprout up between buildings, their needles the same dark green as Montfort's flag. The sunset and the mountains wash the city in alternating stripes of deep pink and darkening purple, light and shadow. Above us, marching into the western distance, snowy peaks stand triumphant beneath a sky that seems too big and too close. A few early stars pinprick the dusk. They are familiar, forming patterns I know. I have never seen a city like this, and it worries me. I do not like surprises, nor do I like to be impressed. It means something is better than me, or my blood, or my homeland. But Ascendant, Montfort, Davidson, they've done it. I can't help but be awed by this strange, beautiful place. It's less than a mile to the city, but the many steps make it seem longer. I think the Premier wants to show off, so rather than stuff us all into transports, he forces us to walk and see the city fully. If I were back in the court of a Kalor king with some other noble on my arm, I wouldn't bother making conversation. The presence of House Samos is well reputed. But here, I have to prove myself. I sigh, grit my teeth, and look to Davidson at my side. I understand you were elected to your position. The word is foreign to me, rolling around my mouth like a smooth stone. Davidson can't help but chuckle, a small crack in his inscrutable mask.
Yes, indeed. 2 years ago, the nation voted, and on the third year, next spring, we do so again.
Who voted precisely? His mouth tightens.
All kinds, if that's what you mean. Red, silver, ardent. A ballot is colorblind.
So you do have silvers here? They said as much before, but I doubted any silver would condescend to a life alongside any red, let alone to be ruled by one. Even a new blood. Still, it puzzles me. Why live here as an equal when they could live elsewhere as a god? Davidson dips his chin.
We have many.
And they just allow this? I scoff, not bothering to hold my tongue. I only do that around my parents, and they aren't here, having thrown me to these red-blooded wolves.
Allow our equal existence, you mean?
The Premier's voice takes on a sharper edge, hissing through the mountain air. His eyes bore into mine, gold into charcoal gray. We continue walking, both of us sure over the many steps. He wants me to apologize. I do not. Finally, we reach a landing, a marble terrace overlooking a wide garden in full bloom. Unfamiliar flowers, purple and orange and pale blue, spiral out before us, wild and fragrant. Some yards ahead, Mare Barrow and her family pick their way through the garden, led by their own Montfort escorts. One of her brothers stoops to inspect the flowers more closely. While the rest of our group takes in the expanse of the garden, Davidson draws closer to me, his lips almost brushing my ear. I resist the urge to slice him in two.
Forgive me for my bluntness, Princess Evangeline, he whispers. But you have a female lover, don't you? And you are forbidden to marry her.
I swear, I'm going to cut the tongues from the mouths of everyone here. Is no secret sacred?
I don't know what you mean,
I growl through a clenched jaw.
Of course you do. She's married to your brother. Part of an arrangement, yes?
My hands tighten around a stone railing. The cool smoothness does nothing to soothe me. I dig in my fingers, and the sharp, jeweled points of my decorative claws scratch deep. Davidson keeps on, his words a tumult, low and fast and impossible to ignore.
If all were as you wished, if you were not a bargaining chip in a crown, and she was not wed, could you marry her? Under the best of circumstances, would the silvers of Norta allow what you desire?
I turn to him, teeth bared. The Premier is far too close. He doesn't flinch or step back. I can see the tiny imperfections in his skin. Wrinkles, scars, even pores. I could claw his eyes right out of his head if I wanted to. Marriage has nothing to do with desire, I snap. Marriage is for heirs and nothing else. For reasons I can't fathom, his golden eyes soften. I see pity. I see regret. I hate it.
So you are denied what you want because of what you are. A choice you never made. A piece of yourself you cannot change and do not want to change.
I
look down on my country all you want,
he murmurs, and I see a shadow of the temper he works to keep hidden.
Question the way things are. Perhaps the answers will be to your liking.
Then he steps back a little, returning to the picture of a politician, an ordinary man of ordinary charm.
Of course, I hope you enjoy our dinner this evening. My husband, Carmadon, has been busy enough preparing for you all.
What? I can only blink. Of course not, I misheard. My cheeks flush with heat, turning gray with shame. I can't deny that my heart leapt in my chest, a burst of adrenaline coursing through me only to die in a heartbeat. It's no use wishing for impossible things. But the Premier moves his head, the slightest nod. I didn't mishear, and he didn't misspeak.
Another small thing we allow here in Montfort, Princess Evangeline.
He drops my arm without ceremony, quickening his pace to put some distance between us. I feel my heart hammer in my chest. Is he lying? Is what he said even possible? To my bewilderment, sharp tears prick at my eyes and my chest tightens.
Diplomacy was never your strong suit.
Cal glowers at my shoulder, his grandmother hanging back to whisper with one of the Eral lords. I turn my head, hiding for a moment in a curtain of silver hair, just long enough to regain some semblance of control. Luckily, he's decidedly occupied with staring after Mare, tracking her movements with pitiful longing. Then why did you pick me? I finally sneer back at him, hoping he feels every ounce of my rage and pain. Why make someone like me a queen when all I'll be is a thorn in your side?
Playing dumb isn't your strong suit either, Evangeline. You know how this works.
I know you had a choice, Kalor. Two paths, and you chose the one that leads right through me.
Choice?
He barks.
You girls love that word.
My eyes roll in my skull. Well, you seem to be a stranger to it, blaming everyone and everything else for a decision you made.
A decision I had to make.
He turns to me, eyes flashing.
Or what? You think Annabelle and your father and the rest would have allied with the Reds anyway, without getting something in the bargain? You think they wouldn't find someone else to back, someone worse? At least, if it's me, I can...
I step neatly in front of him, putting us chest to chest. My shoulder square, ready for battle. A lifetime of training hardens beneath my skin. What? Make things better? When all the fighting is done, you think you can sit on your new throne and wave your stupid flames and change the way the world is? With a sneer, I size him up, my eyes ripping a path from his boots to his forehead. Don't make me laugh, Tiberius Kalor. You're a puppet as much as I am, but at least you had a chance to cut your strings.
And you don't?
I would if I could, I whisper, and I think I mean it. If Elaine were here, if there were some way we could stay...
When the time comes, when we have to marry...
He stumbles over the words. It isn't like a Kalor to stammer.
I'll try to make things as easy as I can. State visits, meetings, you and Elaine can do as you like.
A chill runs through me, as long as I hold up my end of the bargain. The prospect disgusts us both, and we look away from each other.
I'm not doing anything without your consent,
he mutters. Even though I'm not surprised, a tiny burst of relief blooms in my heart. I'd cut something off if you tried. Cal offers a weak laugh, little more than an expulsion of air.
What a mess.
He mumbles, so low he might not expect me to hear. I suck in a shaky breath. You can still choose her. The words hang in the air, torturing us both. He doesn't reply, now glaring at his booted feet. In the garden, Mare keeps her back to him, following close at her sister's heels. Despite their differing hair colors, I see the resemblance. They move in the same way, careful. Quiet, deliberate, like mice. The sister picks a flower as they go, a pale green bloom with vibrant petals, then tucks it into her hair. As I watch, the tall red boy, the one Mare insists on dragging everywhere, does the same. The flower looks silly behind his ear, and both Barrow sisters double over. Their laughter echoes over us, a taunt more than anything. They are red. They are lesser, and they are happy. How can this be? Stop moping, Kalor, I grind out through gritted teeth. The advice is for both of us. You forged this crown yourself. Now wear it. Or don't.
7. Iris. The banks of the Ohias are high. It was a wet spring, with the southern farms of the Lakelands almost flooding many times. Teora was here in the unstable borderlands just a few weeks ago, to help save the new crops as much as she was to smile and wave. Her small, rare grin won us some favor here, but not enough. Reports to the Crown say that Reds are still fleeing, crossing the hills into the rift to the east. They are fools if they believe the Silver King there will offer them a better life. The smarter ones cross the Ohias into the disputed territories, where no king or queen rules. But they have to risk the chaos of such a journey, facing Red and Silver alike between the Lakelands and northern Piedmont. The rise above the river offers a commanding view of the valley, a good place to wait. I look south, into the woods gleaming golden beneath the waning light of afternoon. Today was easy, filled with travel across the corn and wheat. And Maven was kind enough to take his own transport, allowing me long hours of peace as we rolled south. The journey was almost a reprieve, even if it meant leaving my mother and sister behind. They're back in the capital. I can't say when I'll see them again. If I ever do. In spite of the pleasant breeze and the warm air, Maven elects to wait in his vehicle. For now. He'll certainly try to make some kind of entrance when the Piedmontese arrive.
"He is late," the old woman mutters at my side.
In spite of the circumstances, I feel a corner of my mouth lift.
"Patience, Chidansa." "My, how the current has changed, Your Majesty," she chuckles, the wrinkles on her brown face deepening as she grins. "I can remember giving you the same counsel more than once, usually in regard to food."
I break my vigil, looking away from the horizon to glance at her. In that, the current remains true. Her dusty laugh deepens, echoing out across the river. Jidansa of the Marin line has been a friend of the family for as long as I can remember, close as an aunt and doting as a nanny. She used her Telki ability to amuse T and me as children, juggling our shoes or toys with her mind. Despite her lined face, white hair, and matronly disposition, Jidansa is a fearsome opponent, a Telki talented beyond measure, one of the best in our nation. I would ask her to return with me to Norta, if I were not so heartless. She would agree, but I know better than to make such a request. Most of her family died in the war. Living among Nordens would be a punishment she doesn't deserve. Her presence is calming. Even if we were in the Lakelands, I still feel unease around Maven. The rest of my escort fans out behind me, allowing a respectful distance. The sentinels should make me feel safe, but I can never feel at ease beneath their jeweled gaze. They would kill me if my husband commanded it. Or try, at the very least. I fold my arms in front of me, feeling the edges of my blue traveling jacket. Even though I'm about to meet a prince of Piedmont, the ruling prince, I look woefully underdressed. Hopefully he isn't as dedicated to appearance as most silvers I know. I don't have to wait much longer to find out. From our vantage point, we can see his convoy picking its way across the disputed territories. The land is otherwise indistinguishable from the woods of the southern Lakelands. There are no walls, no gates, no roads to mark this part of the border. Our own patrols are well hidden for now, and instructed to let the Piedmont prince pass unimpeded. His convoy is small, even compared to our meager group of 6 transports and 50 or so guards. I spot only 2 transports, fast and agile machines, tearing low across the sparser edges of the forest. They're painted in camouflage, a sickly green to match the landscape. As they get closer, I can see the yellow, white, and purple stars dotting their sides. Bracken. Behind me, metal groans, and Maven steps down from his transport. He crosses the flattened grass in a few quick strides, stopping next to me with even grace. Slowly, he folds his hands. His white skin looks more golden in this light. He could almost seem human.
"I did not take Prince Bracken to be such a trusting man. He is a fool," he says, gesturing to the prince's small party.
"Desperation makes fools of most," I answer coolly. Maven barks out a single laugh. His eyes drag over me in an almost lazy fashion.
Not you.
No, not me. This needle must be gently threaded. Like Maven, I fold my hands together, projecting an image of strength, determination, steel. Bracken's children have been missing for months, imprisoned and used as leverage. Every moment they are gone as another bit of Piedmont bled away. Montfort has already cost them millions of crowns, using whatever they get their hands on. Guns, jets, food stores. The military base in the Lowcountry was stripped, with much of its contents shipped back to the mountains. The Montfortans are locusts, feeding upon all they can. Whatever resources Bracken has left are almost spent. The transports coast to a halt some yards away, keeping a safe distance from our own convoy. When they open, a dozen guards troop out, resplendent in dark purple edged in gold. They carry swords and guns, though a few seem to favor warhammers or axes instead of blades. Bracken carries no weapons at all. He is tall, black-skinned, with a smooth complexion, full lips, and eyes like two polished stones of jet. Where Maven is draped in his cape, his medals, and his crown, Bracken seems less reliant on style. His clothes are finely made, dark purple edged in gold to match his guards. But I see no crown, no furs, no jewels. This man is here on a dire mission and has no cause for pageantry. The prince towers over us both, with the muscular physique of a strong arm, though I know for a fact that Bracken is a mimic. If he were to touch me, he would be able to use my nymph abilities, albeit only for a time and to a lesser extent. The same goes for any silver. Perhaps even new bloods, too.
I wish our first meeting were under better circumstances, he says in a deep, rumbling voice.
As is custom, he ducks into a shallow bow, observing both our ranks. He might rule Piedmont, but his country is no match for ours.
As do we, Your Highness, I reply, offering a nod of my own.
Maven copies my motions, but too quickly, as if he wants this to be over with as soon as possible.
What do you have for us?
I wince at the lack of tact. On instinct, I open my mouth, ready to smooth over the rough edges of a precarious conversation. But to my surprise, Bracken grins.
I don't like to waste time either, he replies,
his smile taking on a hard edge. Over his shoulder, one of his guards approaches, carrying a leather-bound folio in hand.
Not when my children hang in the balance.
This is your intelligence on Montfort, I ask, eyeing the papers as the guard passes them to her prince. You pulled this together so quickly.
The prince has been searching for his children and for people to help in his endeavor for months, Maven drawls. I remember your envoys, the princes Alexandrette and Dorais. I'm sorry I couldn't be of any help to them.
I almost snort aloud. One of the princes died in the Archeon Palace, killed in a failed coup to overthrow Maven himself, and the other is dead too, as far as I know. Bracken dismisses the apology with a wave of one large hand.
They knew the risks, as do all in my service. I've lost dozens to the search for my son and daughter.
There is true sorrow in his words, laced beneath the anger. Let us hope we don't lose any more, I mutter, thinking of myself, and what my mother said. It must be you. Maven raises his chin, his eyes flashing between Bracken and the folio. It has to be filled with information on Montfort, their mysterious cities, their mountains, their armies. Information we need.
We're prepared to do what you cannot, Bracken, he says.
Maven is a skilled performer, and he layers his words with just the right amount of sympathy. If given the chance, the young king might lure Bracken to his side before I even get a chance to play my hand.
I understand that, while the Montfortans hold your children, you can't move against them. The smallest rescue mission could jeopardize their lives. Yes, exactly true.
Bracken nods rapidly. He's eating up everything Maven gives him.
Even gathering intelligence was almost too dangerous.
The Norton King raises an eyebrow.
And? We were able to track the children to their capital, Ascendant, the prince offers.
He extends his hand, holding out the folio to us.
It's deep in the mountains, protected by a valley. Our maps of the city are old, but usable.
I take the information before one of the sentinels can, weighing the folio. It's heavy, worth its weight in gold. Were you able to find where they're being held? I ask, eager to crack open the pages and get to work. Bracken dips his head.
I believe so. At great cost.
I cross my arms, cradling the substantial book to my chest. I won't waste it. The Piedmont prince looks me up and down, his face pulled in respectful confusion.
Maven is less obvious.
He doesn't move, and his expression doesn't change. The temperature doesn't rise a single degree. But I can smell the suspicion rolling off him, and the warning. He's smart enough to keep his mouth shut in front of the prince, unable to stop me from spinning my web. I'm leading the team myself, I offer, fixing Bracken with my most determined stare. He doesn't blink, resolute as a statue. Examining me, weighing me. The simple clothing was a good choice on my part. I look more like a warrior than a queen. I'll use Norton soldiers and soldiers of the Lakelands, a small enough force to pass through unnoticed. Rest assured, we've been hard at work since yesterday. Even though it makes my skin crawl, I put a hand on Maven's arm. His flesh is cold beneath his sleeve. I can't see it, but I feel the tiniest tremble in him. My smile widens. Maven came up with a brilliant plan. He slides his hand over mine, fingers like ice. A threat, plain as day.
Indeed I did, Maven says, his lips pulling into a feral smile to match my own.
Bracken sees only the offer and the possibility of his children's rescue. I don't blame him. I can only imagine what my mother would do if Tiora and I were in the same position. The prince breathes a long sigh of relief.
Magnificent, he offers, bowing his head one more time. And in return, I can pledge to uphold the alliance we've had for decades, until the blood freaks decided to intervene.
Bracken hardens.
But no more. The tide turns today.
I feel his words as keenly as I feel the river below, flowing in its course. Unbreakable. Unstoppable. The tide turns today, I echo, the folio tight in hand. This time, Maven climbs into my transport after me, and I'm tempted to kick him back out in the grass. Instead, I retreat to the farthest corner of my seat, Bracken's intelligence laid across my knees. Maven keeps his eyes on me as he sits down. His calm manner almost makes me sweat. I wait for him to speak, matching his icy gaze with my own. Inwardly, I curse his presence. I want to crack into the papers and start filling in the gaps in my rescue plan. But I can hardly start with Maven sneering at me. And he knows it. He's enjoying this, as he always enjoys bothering people. I think it makes him feel better about his own demons, to make demons for everyone else. Only after the transport is moving, hurtling away from the borderlands at high speed, does he speak.
What exactly are you doing?
He asks, his voice smooth and devoid of all emotion. It's his favorite tactic, giving no indication as to his mood. It's useless to search his eyes or his face for any feeling, to try to read him as I would any other person. He's too skilled for that. I answer simply, head held high. Winning Piedmont for us. Us. Maven hmms deep in his throat, before settling back for the long journey.
Very well, he says, and speaks no more.
8. Mare. The Montfort escort leads us toward a palatial compound set high on a ridge overlooking the central valley, where the rest of Ascendant clings to the slopes. Everywhere, dark green banners drift in the sweet evening breeze, bearing the mark of the white triangle. A mountain, I realize, feeling silly for not having figured out their symbol sooner. Their uniform